Good morning, LifePoint. It is Thursday, August 27th, and we're continuing our work through 1st and 2nd Samuel, and we'll be finishing up 1st Samuel this morning. I'm joined by the esteemed and venerable Dr. Meese, or soon to be Dr. Meese. I think he is in the middle of writing a lot of papers and doing a lot of reading for his doctoral work, and he tried to tell me the title of his dissertation, which he himself could not remember. So apparently it is not the most exciting work.
That's right.
But it was on something about the Trinity, and it was a really, really long title. And do you care to share the title of this Trinitarian work, Meese?
So as of right now, I actually haven't started writing the dissertation. I'm still in the prep work to getting all of the classes out of the way before I can actually start writing a dissertation. But the dissertation topic, and at least prospective title, is The Trinity and the Covenant of Redemption, specifically as it, now this specifically isn't a part of the title, but specifically as it applies to the simple Trinity and the one undivided will of our triune God and the personal appropriations of this one will within the context of the covenant of redemption. So I really don't feel bad about not being able to remember it, because I'm pretty sure any Puritan you would have talked to with their, you know, whole cover titles would have been like, I don't remember the title of it. But yeah, so anyway, that's kind of where I am.
Well, there you go. That's a little teaser for for our listeners as they eagerly await the publication of the dissertation that you are writing. So there you go. Well, here's where we are in 1 Samuel, and basically, and just in a few sentences, if you'll remember, you have this transition from the judges to the monarchy in Israel. The people want a king like all the other nations, and God relents and gives them a king that looks like kings of all the other nations. Saul is tall and mighty and looks the part, and he is proving himself even through our reading today to be a lackluster king. In fact, you're going to see that he really begins to take on the look of the serpent, and as he seeks to kind of strike at the heel of the king, as he kills priests, as he does things that are clearly antithetical to God's ways. And so he's not a good king. He's a king who has taken and taken and taken, which Samuel warned the people about in chapter 8. And there has been a better king that has been anointed. He's not the perfect king, but he's a better king. And we kind of are entering now into what some theologians call David's outlaw period, where he doesn't really have a home. He's not fully embraced in Israel because he's on the run, and yet he finds himself in Philistia numerous times, and there's some odd stories in the end of 1 Samuel, so we'll let Dr. Meese kind of shed some light on how we should read these, not only from a theological standpoint, but also from a literary standpoint as well. So, Nate, is there anything that you'd like to add getting us up to chapter 22?
No, I think that's a really good, just very brief and 50,000-foot flyby overview. I think that, as you pointed out, that these back chapters of 1 Samuel really depict David as one who has no place to lay his head, right? And there's going to be a lot of typological realities that are in this back half, how certain aspects of David's life are just pointing forward to the life of Christ, our Messiah, who is going to come and who is going to, in effect, fulfill so many of these different aspects in this back half of 1 Samuel. He will be the one who has no place to lay his head, who will be calling people who are weary and heavy laden to himself. He will be the one who takes upon himself the sins of his people. He will be the one who is rejected and despised by those who he came to save. And we'll see all of those realities kind of play out through this back half. But at least in the historical context, this really is, as you said, the outlaw time period for David. I mean, he's kind of risen up in power in the sense that he is in Saul's court. And Saul realizes that that David is rising in fame, while his reign, Saul's reign, is slowly working its way down and out. And then you see Saul trying to kill David and having this animus towards David. And here in this back half, it'll be the transition from Saul being king to his demise, and then David being on the run to his being raised up as king over the people of Israel. So you see that flip-flop, which we've already talked about at the beginning in Hannah's prayer and at the end in David's prayer, how the mightier brought low and the humbler raised up. And we see that taking place here in the back half of Samuel. So,
yeah, and one of the things I'd encourage our listeners to pay attention to is how God's favor is not only resting on David via his presence and via his spirit, which you see used that phrase numerous times, but also as the favor of the people is there, most notably in Jonathan, and I think you pronounce it McCall, in her devotion to David, as those who would be, you know, really close to Saul, even their devotion seems to begin lying with David. And then as the people's loyalty begins to shift, and then even David finding favor in Philistia, with kind of questions for you in regard to that. There's some odd interactions that begin to take place and, that we probably need to shed some light on. So,
sure.
Well, why don't you start walking us through where we're starting in chapter 22. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to go back just a little bit to chapter 21. There's a kind of a nefarious character who's introduced to us, Doeg Edomite, who's going to play, he's just kind of, I picture him just kind of being behind the scenes, constantly whispering in Saul's ears. Is he, he's kind of a guy who doesn't really get out in front, but he's just there. He's just this kind of ubiquitous presence over the course of the next couple of chapters. Mm-hmm. So starting in chapter 21, with this holy bread and David fleeing to Gath, kind of launch that into chapter 22, because as he leaves from there, there's already, at least from a literary standpoint, a kind of a shadow that's being cast on the next few or the next few episodes anyway.
Sure. Well, in chapter 21, as you mentioned, David is on his way out. He goes to Nob. Ahimelech the priest is there. David is asking for food because he and his young men who are with him are hungry, and the only thing that's available is the bread of the presence. What's really interesting here is if we look at chapters 22 through the end of 1 Samuel as this picture of David being in the wilderness, so to speak, we have his preparation for being taken off into the wilderness, right? He's being sustained by the bread of the presence. Then he's taken off into the wilderness, which is very similar. I mean, even if you consider the way that Jesus was in his baptism, the word spoken over him, this is my beloved son with whom I'm well pleased. And then being, in a sense, the Holy Spirit coming upon him, and then the Holy Spirit taking him out into the wilderness, preparing him for the wilderness journey. We see that kind of in incipient form here in the life of David. So he's being prepared to go off into the wilderness as an outlaw. And then, as you mentioned, this pretty bad dude named Doeg. So if you're ever interested in naming your son Doeg, I would like vote against it. The dude's not a good man. And Doeg is also just a weird name anyway in our culture today. But he's an Edomite. So we have this sense he's coming from the line of Edom, which is from the line of Esau, not from the line of Jacob. So, I mean, we have here this picture of one who's outside the covenant, and he's a chief of Saul's herdsmen. And so he's overseeing the flock of Saul, and he's actually seeming to do a better job than Saul did of finding the flock that was lost from his father's household. So he just have these interesting parallels there. Mm-hmm. But he sees David in Nob, and then eventually you have David asking for a sword from Ahimelech, and then he gets Goliath's sword, which is really just the preparation, as it were, for his being sent off into the wilderness. So again, we see the connections between how chapter 21 is preparing David to be sent off into the wilderness to be an outlaw, as it were, and how that actually typifies and comes to perfect fulfillment in Christ himself, who is prepared to go out into the wilderness and win the battle, right? We will see David's errors and his faults even as he's out in the wilderness, so to speak, where Christ himself will perfectly succeed and as he's in the wilderness. So that's kind of the backdrop for chapter 22 as we move in. So in chapter 22, you have David, again, departing. He's departing from Gath, which was one of the chief cities of the land of Philistia. So the chief cities of the land of the Philistines. And even there you see David and his cunningness, his ability to act a particular way in light of where he is in the context he is. And I think we talked about last week, is that something of cowardice on the part of David? I would say, no, that's his shrewdness. He's acting shrewdly. So anyhow, he leaves Gath of the Philistines and he departs and goes to the cave of Adullam. And here is when we start to see some of those even stronger ties to the greater David, you know, King David's greater son, as it were. It says in verse 2, everyone who was in distress and everyone who was in debt and everyone who was bitter in soul gathered to him, and he became commander over them, and there were with him about 400 men. And so even there, if we have ears to hear and we have a New Testament context before us, I mean, that sounds an awful lot like Jesus's words, right? Come to me, all who are weary and heavy laden, and I'll give you rest for your soul. We come under the kingship of our commander in chief, Christ Jesus. Here, David is bringing the most unlikely of ragtag bunches to himself. And these are going to be the men that he kind of moves forward with. So we see there this connection with Christ himself. And then we have in verse 4, left them with the king of Moab. They stayed with him all the time that David was in the stronghold. And the prophet Gad said to David, do not remain in the stronghold. Depart and go into the land of Judah. So David departed and went into the forest of Pereth. And then what's really interesting in chapter 22 is those priests at Nob who were present, Ahimelech being the primary spokesman, we have this picture in chapter 22 of Saul coming in and basically laying waste all of the priests of Nob. And he'll do that through the hand of that, you know, nasty dude Doeg, right? I mean, it's really interesting in the narrative itself that in verse 17, it says, and the king said to the guard who stood about him, turn and kill the priests of the Lord. And he's calling down judgment on the priests of the Lord because they failed to give David into the hands of Saul. And it says, because their hand is also with David, and they knew that he fled and did not disclose it to me. So you've got this wickedness of Saul being displayed, but then the righteousness of his servants being contrasted. It's really kind of this interesting chiasm, the wickedness of Saul, the righteousness of the servants, and then the wickedness of Doeg. But the servants of the king would not put out their hand to strike the priests of the Lord. They're fearing the Lord and the Lord's anointed ones, right? The same thing David himself will display. And then Doeg rises up. He's the wicked dude. And he goes and he slays down the priests. It says he killed on that day 85 persons who wore the linen ephod. I mean, that's 85 individuals who were set apart for the work of the Lord in the priesthood. And then in Nob, the city of the priests, he put to the sword both man and woman, child and infant, ox, donkey, sheep, he put to the sword, this Doeg, the Edomite. And it's a picture, really, of the ban that we saw in Joshua, how Joshua was to go in and lay waste all of the cities, because the Lord called him to do that. And here, the same thing's taking place, but it's because of the sinfulness of men that this is actually occurring. So there's that picture. And then at the end of chapter 22, we see David himself saying in verse 22, I have occasioned the death of all the persons of your father's house. So David is in a sense taking responsibility for what happened to those priests and the people of Nob. And it's really interesting, the comparison, really, because David seems to be taking this representative responsibility when he wasn't actually the one responsible for the death of those people of Nob and the priests of Nob. But then you see the comparison, how Jesus himself takes upon himself the responsibility to both keep the covenant and take the curse of the covenant as well. So that's kind of chapter 22 in a nutshell. Anything that you would want to add to that?
No, I think it's a really dark chapter that kind of launches. I mean, if you sit there and read it for what it is, you really do see, you know, I think sometimes we see Saul's decline almost as inconsequential in many ways, but there's a ton of collateral damage. Mm-hmm. He really does begin to take on. I mean, you do see so to speak, two seeds beginning to play out as Saul really does begin to move into the camp of the seed of the serpent, right? And striking at the heel, not only of the king, but now at the priests and at the people of God and lashing out, even if it's passively, right? Even if it's through Doeg, there still is this line of demarcation that is beginning to be drawn between the two. Mm-hmm. Now, as we kind of move here through the next couple of chapters, Nate, if you could kind of maybe preemptively, there's a strange relationship that David has with Philistia. It seems like he's, you know, taking shelter there at times. He's fighting them at times. For the lay reader and not just lay reader, I mean, even myself, this is kind of a confusing element. Like, what is the nature of this relationship and why is it here? Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, what is the author attempting to tell us other than, and as I kind of thought through this week, that David is not only held in high esteem in Israel, but we already noted that God's reign extends even into Philistia, right? I mean, we remember Dagon falling down before the ark, and as it's almost as if the author is preparing us for the fact that God's reign is universal, and even David is in Philistia, he is still under the sovereign care of the covenant keeping God. But there are times here where we see, you know, his relationship to Achish seems to be very positive. Mm-hmm. Same time, he's inquiring of the Lord, do I go up and fight these people? But they're sheltering him at times. So how would you kind of describe that? Maybe that's not a fair question. I didn't give it to you before we met. How would you walk us through what is the nature of this relationship and what's going on? There's a little drama.
Yeah, well, I think that one of the aspects of the relationship that's kind of going on between David and Philistia is very similar to what Paul would say to the Corinthians, you know, you're to be in the world, but not of the world, right? And for David, he's been really pushed out from the land of promise, you know, this growing kingdom that'll continue to expand under his rule and under his reign. But under the kingship of Saul, he's being pushed out. He's being pushed out from the land, and in a sense, coming to rest in the land of his enemies. And we begin to see, even as you've kind of pointed out, the reality that God's sovereignty is not, it's not a sphere sovereignty. It's not like he just is a sovereign over this sphere here, but not over this sphere here. He's sovereign over the universe. So wherever David goes to rest, he's going to be underneath the sovereign care of God. But here it's really interesting because I think that there's a contrast that is kind of going on in that there's a picture of the promised land not being a place of rest. And then interestingly enough, the place of the enemies of the people of God, David is in a sense finding rest in. That doesn't mean that he is now of the world, but it does mean that he is in the world and he is operating still under the sovereign sphere and under the sovereign control and prerogative of God. So even when he's resting in the land of Philistia, as it were, it's not as though he's acting like the Philistines. Sure. There's a unique distinction there. And I just think that's good for us to remember that, because sometimes I think we could just get this misunderstanding that we're still living in a Christian nation, right? And that's just becoming less and less apparent. So we need to be more apt to say, look, we live under the sphere, the sovereign sphere of God, which extends throughout the whole world. And we need to be representatives of our King wherever we are. And that also means that we need to be in the world, but not of the world. So we need to be living distinctly, even when we're outside of what we might say our homeland. Sure. So, and that also reminds us of what Paul would say, that our primary residence, we are civilians of a heavenly kingdom, and that should take precedence over where we are in our homeland physically or geographically. So I don't know if that's helpful, if that answers any of the questions that you asked.
No, that's a good reminder. It's interesting to see David kind of back and forth in Philistia and you know, here in chapter 23, he's going to go fight him. Mm-hmm. And yet, and a few chapters later, he seems to be their buddies with some of the leaders. And so it's just an interesting and maybe even confusing dynamic, but I think that's a good reminder for us. So, all right, so get us up to speed here in chapter 23. David inquires of the Lord, should I go up and save this city? And so what's going on here?
Yeah, so chapter 23 starts with David being told that the Philistines are fighting against Keilah and they're robbing the threshing floors. So David goes, like you said, to inquire from the Lord, should he go up and should he attack the Philistines? And the Lord says, yes, go up, attack the Philistines and save Keilah. But David's men said, how, behold, we are afraid here in Judah, how much more than if we go up to Keilah against the armies of the Philistines? And then David again inquires of the Lord, and the Lord answered him, arise, go down to Keilah, for I will give the Philistines into your hands. And again, that's just a constant reminder that we have been reminded of over and over and over again, that the Lord fights the battles for the people of Israel. And David is depicting really a righteous posture, that he's going before the Lord to ask the Lord what he should be doing here in this particular instance. And it, ultimately, David ends up saving the inhabitants of Keilah. And then what's really interesting is that right after that, right after David comes in to save this city, Saul's on his way to come get David. And David inquires of the Lord again. And he's like, you know, what should we do? Especially when you look at, say, verse 11, will the men of Keilah surrender me into his hand, the Saul's hand? Will Saul come down and as your servants have heard? O Lord, the God of Israel, please tell your servant. The Lord said, he will come down. And then David asked, will the men of Keilah surrender me and my men into the hand of Saul? And the Lord said, yes, they will surrender you. So the city that has just been rescued by David is willing to give David over into the hands of Saul. And as I mentioned earlier, I mean, these are typological realities that are going to be fulfilled in the person and work of Jesus. Jesus comes to redeem a people, and we see his own people giving him over into the hands of the Roman soldiers who will then crucify him. So it's just very interesting, those parallels that we see. One of the things that I think is really important for us to take into consideration, especially in this text here, is the fact that the Lord knows both everything that is possible and actual, right? Because he says, yes, the men of Keilah will give you over into the hands of Saul, but that doesn't actually come to pass because David doesn't stick around, right? But had David stuck around, the men of Keilah would have given David into the hands of Saul. So it's just a good reminder that the Lord knows all things, both possible and actual. His omniscience is not constrained to actuality. His omniscience is much more robust to both the possible and the actual. So David flees, and then Saul just continues his pursuit of David. And then in verse 16, we see Jonathan and David coming back together again. And this is just, it's really a beautiful picture of the friendship that Jonathan and David have, because Jonathan is coming with his father Saul, right? He's in his father Saul's army. In verse 16, he rose, went to David at Horesh, and strengthened his hand in God. So we have this continual strengthening of David on the part of Jonathan. And then the words of Jonathan, he said to him, do not fear, for the hand of Saul, my father, shall not find you. You shall be king over Israel, and I shall be next to you. Saul, my father, also knows this. Jonathan's aware that Saul is fully understanding that David's going to be being raised up for kingship. But then you have Jonathan's acknowledgement, right? This acknowledgement that even though my father is king, and if we just think about heirs, I should be the rightful king that's next in line. He realizes that the kingship has been taken from Saul and given to David. And he says, look, you're going to be king over Israel, and then I'll be next to you. His allegiance is now it's transitioned from Saul to David, and it's almost as if his familial ties have transitioned as well. Yeah. So we have Saul continuing to pursue David, and then we have what's really interesting is as you begin to look at how this pursuit takes place, David eventually cuts the corner off of Saul's robe, and then you have two individuals on two mountains like calling down to one another, and it's very much like what we read between David and Goliath. Right. You have two champions now calling down, and some of the language it's being used is very similar to the language that that Goliath would speak towards David. And David himself says, am I a flea? You know, am I just so small here that you would come at me like this? And so we have, again, just this picture of two champions that are one is righteous, the other is unrighteous, very much like you had Goliath and David, an unrighteous champion and a righteous champion in David. So that kind of culminates in this kind of back and forth between Saul and between David. And then what chapter 23 kind of ends with is David going up from there and living in the strongholds of En-Gedi. a place where there's going to be wadis and water and some sustenance. So he's being provided for even as he's off in the wilderness. So that's chapter 23 really in a nutshell there.
Yeah, and you know, and chapter 24 is going to be very similar, at least in terms of narrative direction. And I remember being as a kid and getting so frustrated with David, because it was like, David, he's trying to kill you. You know, I mean, at what point do you just say, okay, enough's enough? But I think it's a reminder to the reader, and I think, you know, that the author goes out of his way to demonstrate to Israel and to us that the kingship was not in any way stolen, right? It was not, this was not an earthly coup, so to speak, that David is responsible for the death of Saul, that this king is going to be different. He's not going to kill the king and all of his descendants, as would have been custom in the ancient world, so that nobody else had a stake to that. To that throne. And so David has befriended the rightful heir in Jonathan. Later on, he's going to extend a tremendous amount of grace to Mephibosheth. And so I just think it's a reminder to us as this narrative just kind of, for us, it may just kind of drone on because it's, you know, you see the hunting, David's got an opportunity. He doesn't kill Saul. Saul, you know, is vulnerable again. David doesn't kill him. And it's just the author's way of saying, look, this is the Lord's anointing. This is the Lord giving the kingship to David. David in no way has taken this. There is nothing manipulative about what has gone on in this transition of power. Mm-hmm. And it's important for us to remember that. So even you're kind of like, why are we doing this again? Mm-hmm. I think author's repetition to drive home that point to Israel when David does take the kingship, that this is the Lord's work and his fingerprints are all over this.
Right. Yeah. And in a sense too, just as you pointed out, David's not usurping the kingship. He's actually not even going to be the one that brings ultimate judgment upon Saul. You have at the very end in chapter 31, this picture of Saul and the judgment of God being brought about by Saul's own hand, right? Mm-hmm. He's shot in battle and then he takes his own life. So you've got the judgment of God on Saul, and that's David's not even the one who's enacting that judgment. So right. There's this righteousness of David that should be clear throughout the text to indicate to us David hasn't sinfully stolen the kingship. He was rightfully proclaimed and anointed king. Rightfully anointed king, and he is not willing to lay his hand against God's anointed. So there's this transition that is right and good that takes place right in the text. So,
yeah, one of the other things that stood out to me here is this role that Philistia has in being both an enemy, so to speak, of David, and a tool of his deliverance at times. So even subtly there at the end of chapter 23. You know, it looks like the messengers of Saul begin to enclose David. And then, you know, it says, you know, that Philistia is raiding Israel and Saul has to leave, right? So mm-hmm. even kind of passively, the Lord uses the Philistines as a tool of deliverance for David. Right. Though that's just, you know, it's just a reminder to us that, you know, that God uses in many ways natural means in miraculous ways for our own benefit and for our own deliverance. And, you know, was David able to see those, you know, fingerprints in his deliverance? I don't know. But we get the benefit now of looking and saying, man, our God is so sovereign that he uses even the enemies of the people of God for his own purposes. And mm-hmm. you know, I can't help but think of just the ways that you know, that we look around at the persecuted church globally and we wonder why the Lord allows the things that he allows, and then we see the gospel just, you know, spreading like wildfire in places in Africa and China and India, whereas we have such a tendency to kind of have a pity party here in America as we see, you know, immorality and foundations crumbling, and we kind of look around and say, well, the gospel's dying out. And the Lord's like, no, we need to remind ourselves that the gospel, you know, when Jesus says the gates of hell will not prevail against it, that the image there is that the gospel is on the offense, mm-hmm. right? gates are defensive things. They keep things out. And the gates of hell do not prevail against the gospel. The gospel goes forth. We tend to view it almost as if we're inside the gates and hell is impressing upon us. And, well, the gates are keeping it out. And it really is the opposite image. Just a reminder to us how the Lord uses these things, and that there's a million things going on that he is perfectly sovereign in, perfectly in control in. And while we look at things like a virus and a pandemic, we look at things like persecution, and we just sit back and say, this is for our good. We don't know how. We don't know how it plays out, but it is shaping the people of God. It is for the benefit of his church, for the joy of his people, and for his name's sake. Even in the same way that this is really shaping David, as hard as this was, my guess is this was not a romantic period in his life, right? I mean, he's in the wilderness. And I think that there are some Psalms that we can probably trace back to this outlaw period where he's crying out, how long? Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, I don't have a home. I am thirsty. I am hungry. I am surrounded by the Philistines on one side and Saul on another side, and I am surrounded. And we do see, kind of the isolation of David, which does foreshadow the isolation of Christ, right? I mean, he is abandoned. So anyway, there's a whole lot there, and I apologize if that sounded like rambling, but it's just a continual reminder to me that the Lord uses, I used to have a friend who said, the Lord uses crooked screwdrivers to make really cool buildings. Mm-hmm. The Philistines are crooked screwdrivers that the Lord's still using as he's building up the king and beginning to solidify the kingdom of Israel. So,
yeah. Well, just to play off of that just a little bit, you had mentioned that around the world, I mean, sometimes I think we just have such a small, narrow conception of what the church is that we think the church is just an American reality. The church is a global reality, right? And the reality is there are 7,000 that haven't bowed the knee to the American dream.
Right.
I mean, I just recently read a short article, but it was talking about how here in America, the amount of children that we're having is down to a dismal, like 1.1 children per married couple. And that's both inside and outside. That's just a general perspective, which is just very disheartening. Like one of the realities that we as followers of Christ understand is that there is the mandate to go and be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it. And we can put in a lot of caveats there, right? We can put in caveats about how infertility in a fallen world is hard and it's heartbreaking. And we don't ever want to dismiss that. We want to put in a caveat that we want to honor the singles amongst us because not everybody's going to be called to marriage. But for those of us who are called to marriage, one of the things that we have to understand is one of the greatest blessings that, and we haven't been struck with, infertility or something like that, is that God calls us to be fruitful and multiply. And the point that was being made was here in America, because the amount of children that we're having is just so dismal, the reality of the propagation of the gospel will be in other countries, right? In the sense that we're not training up and raising up a number of future Christians. We're actually just kind of following in line with the American dream. Now it's 1.1 child and a white picket fence out front. And instead we're going to see other nations, other countries that understand the importance of godly offspring and how that's a means by which the gospel will continue to go forth. And we're going to look and we're going to see the gospel flourishing in those areas. And we're going to go, what's going on? Why? So anyway, it goes to your point that the Lord is working around the world, and his sovereign control over all things is actually going to lead to the good of his people. And we just need to be aware that the church isn't just an American reality. The church is global. And the Lord is working, and the church, the gates of hell will not prevail against it. And that's true here in America, just as much as it's true outside of the U.S. So.
All right. Well, let's, unless there's something dramatic from chapter 24, and it does begin to transition a little bit, but chapter 25 starts with, it's just very direct. Mm-hmm. Now, it was just, that's what you get. And so all of Israel assembled and mourned for him, and they buried him in their house, in his house at Ramah. This marks the official kind of end of the Judges, right? I mean, Saul kind of is almost this transition period because you still have Samuel there and you still have Saul. But I think that reminds us that really the official kind of monarchy in Israel, definitively the quote golden years. And we only get a couple of chapters of that. Really, it's what? The beginning of 2 Samuel. I mean, mm-hmm. maybe chapter 10, you kind of get the golden years. Sure. And then we see David falls in line with all the other kings because he's going to take Bathsheba, right? Samuel had warned mm-hmm. your king to take. But we kind of have this beginning, at least, of you see David now has lost probably his strongest ally. Mm-hmm. And so, again, that's a subtle little thing that says, okay, David's a little bit more out on his own now too, right? Another support beam has been taken away from David. What's Saul going to do now, right? I mean, even Samuel seemed to have some restraining element on Saul at times. That's now gone. Sure. And so it's just Saul and David, really. So what's going to happen here? Mm-hmm. So what's going on here in chapter 25, you know, which is then kind of that sandwich between another story of David sparing Saul's life. Mm-hmm. So this sandwich right in the middle of these two episodes. And so what do you think the author's trying to tell us and what should we pull from it?
Sure. Well, it's in between these two instances in which David spares Saul's life, right? He's acting righteously in chapters 24 and 26. And then here in chapter 25, what's really interesting is you have a picture of David becoming angry, and then Abigail having to intercede on behalf of David to keep David from acting sinfully, right? So you've got the instance of Abigail and Nabal, this worthless fellow. His name literally means he's like a stupid person. He's just worthless in that sense. But you have this picture of David being slighted and then wanting to go off and just bring complete and utter destruction, and Abigail being the one that intercedes and keeping David from blood guilt. So you have this picture of a sinful kind of anger arising in David's heart, his desire to do something wicked, Abigail interceding so that that doesn't happen. And then at the very end of the chapter, what does David do with Abigail? He takes Abigail to be his wife, right? He's already been married to Michal, right? Now it does say at the end of, into the end of chapter 25, that the Lord, or that Saul had given Michal to another. I thought that was in chapter 25. I could be wrong there. But the reality is David has, he's already married to Michal, and now he's taking Abigail as a wife as well. And then it also says in verse 43 that David took Ahinoam of Jezreel, and both of them became his wives. Yeah, in verse 44, Saul had given Michal, his daughter, David's wife, to Palti, son of Laish, who was of Galim. And just because Saul has given Michal to another doesn't mean that she is any less David's wife. So not only do you have in chapters 24 and 26 these pictures of David acting righteously and sparing Saul's life, in chapter 25 we're also reminded that David is a man and he's also sinful, right? So there's this interesting connection. You've got a picture of David's righteous actions, picture of David's wicked actions, and then another picture of David's righteous actions. So as much as we're expecting this righteous king to come, it still depicts for us David is not that perfectly righteous king. Although he is much better than Saul, he still has sinful tendencies like all of the other kings of the nations. So I think that's really kind of what's the big picture of that narrative between Abigail and David. So.
And I do find it interesting that right at the beginning of the chapter, Samuel's dead, right? The prophetic voice of warning, and here the Lord graciously provides, so to speak, another prophetic voice of warning, right? I mean, even though Samuel is now gone, Abigail intercedes in a really almost, I'm not trying to draw, it's not my feminist statement of the day, but almost in a prophetic word of what she's bringing before David as a reminder and as a kind of a promise forward. And again, we see a typological picture of Christ here is one who overlooks the insult, right? You know, the insults that come upon Christ. And I remember being a kid and just thinking, you know, of all the things that Christ had to endure, you know, sitting on a cross, knowing that you could crush all of the people beneath it at any moment and sitting and enduring mocking, right? I mean, I from a humanistic standpoint, I sit there and, you know, if somebody's challenging you, but you can dunk and nobody knows. And then it's like, all right, here we go. You wait till the game and then you dunk and you hang from the rim and you flex and you point and you say, I have had that all along. So watch it. Mm-hmm. I am doing this only of my own accord. And why Jesus didn't shoot lightning bolts out of his eyeballs and consume his enemies, but he overlooks the insult. And we see a lot of these pictures play out in Isaiah. But again, even here, this overlooking this insult from this worthless, stupid fellow that David could have crushed. And in some ways, I don't know. I mean, he probably would have been justified in doing so, but he doesn't. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that is owing to the intercession of Abigail here, who's a blessing to David. Now, should David have gone and married her? Probably not, right? We're starting to get glimpses, even in the midst of this, that David is not the perfect king, right? Starting to see David's flaws. All of these things are going to, you know, they start out as a seed here, really, in chapter, 25. And then we see him pouring water on that with David and Bathsheba. And then we see the consequences of that familially as it plays out with the turmoil in David's family, right? So again, we're reminded David's a good guy. He's a better king than Saul, but he is far inferior to the perfect king in Jesus. And so, one of the things that stood out to me is how Saul is he is interceded. Or Abigail provides intercession for David in a couple of chapters. We're going to see this witch provide intercession, so to speak, for Saul. Mm-hmm. Abigail's intercession brings life. The Witch of Endor's intercession, so to speak, brings death. And so again, we see this breaking of the lines between Saul and David. And it really is just a cool literary piece when you see the story with Abigail reads redemptively, so to speak, and the story of Saul reads, I don't know what the adjective form of cursing is, but it reads almost as a cursing that brings about death in Saul. And so there's some things that take place in between, but I couldn't help but see the similarities between these two women and what they bring about in the lives of their of the ones that they kind of intercede for.
That's good. Yeah. So as the narrative kind of continues on in chapter 26, we've already talked about this, right? David sparing Saul again. And then in chapter 27, he spares Saul. Then there's at the end of chapter 26, and Saul said to David, "Blessed be you, my son, David, you will do many things and will succeed in them." So David went his way and Saul returned to his place. And then it's as if the light bulb kind of goes on in David's head in chapter 27. Then David said in his heart, "Now I shall perish one day by the hand of Saul. There's nothing better for me than that I should escape to the land of the Philistines. Then Saul will despair of seeking me any longer within the borders of Israel, and I shall escape out of his hand." So it's like, okay, this is just how it's going to be. So then he leaves and he escapes to the land of the Philistines. And this is, again, kind of what you had pointed out earlier, this interesting relationship that David has with the Philistines, especially with Achish, the king of the Philistines, the son of Moach. He's the king of Gath. And it says in verse 3, David lived with Achish at Gath, he and his men, every man with his household, and David with his two wives, Ahinoam of Jezreel and Abigail of Carmel, Nabal's widow. And when it was told Saul that David had fled to Gath, he no longer sought him. So it actually turned out that he goes to the Philistines, Saul ceases to seek for David. And then this interesting relationship that takes place, and then the Philistines are going out. And eventually we see in chapter 29, the Philistines realize David can't come with us. This dude, remember, he's the guy that said Saul killed his thousands, David his tens of thousands. So they are back and forth with Achish, and David eventually is left behind. But there is that interesting interaction in chapter 27 with David and the Philistines. And then verse 12, "And Achish trusted David, thinking, 'He has made himself an utter stench to his people of Israel, therefore he shall always be my servant.'" And this misunderstanding on the part of the king of the Philistines, right, the king of Gath. David has made himself a stench to the people of Israel, but that's only to those who are the wicked in Israel, who are following Saul. He's still rightfully the king who will rule and reign from eventually Jerusalem. And that statement, "therefore he shall always be my servant," or "be my servant forever," is going to quickly show itself to be false. So chapter 27 is really just this very quick snippet of David going to the Philistines. And then chapter 28, you have, which you mentioned earlier, this this witch at Endor who is interceding on behalf of Saul, and how that's a literary foil to the way that Abigail interceded on behalf of David. So you have these two contrasting pictures of one that's bringing life and another that's going to, in a sense, prophesy death, because the witch at Endor calls for Samuel. Samuel, it appears as though this is legit here. I there's been debate as to what's taking place. Is this a demon? Is it not? It would seem in the narrative that this is Samuel speaking from a place of paradise, and the Lord allowing his voice to come forward and basically saying, no, look, you're going to die in battle, you and your sons as well. So Saul is looking for a word of confirmation, and really what he receives is a word of condemnation. So what else should we kind of pull out there of chapter 28 with Saul and the witch at Endor?
Well, I think there's a whole lot. This is a key chapter that begins to kind of build the drama, because we're left there at the, you know, right there in verse one. In those days, the Philistines gathered their forces for war to fight against Israel. Mm-hmm. So we're left out, like, what's David going to do, right? I mean, you don't forget, David's in an interesting predicament here. He's in Philistia. He can't go and fight against Israel. But if you're reading this from a drama standpoint, you got to ask yourself, what is David going to do? Like, how is he going to get out of this? He's going to have to go fight against his people, or is he going to have to kind of, in a sense, reveal his true intentions as the one? Because I don't know that we know that the Philistines know that he's going to be king. I mean, maybe they see the writing on the wall and they see him rising in fame, but I don't know that they understand the prophetic element that David is in fact going to be this king. And one of his purposes is going to be to wipe out the enemies of God. Mm-hmm. So there's an interesting, you know, dynamic going on here. And so, I think we forget that sometimes. We get stuck on the story, forgetting that David is still kind of in this dramatic, purgatory, so to speak, as to what's going to happen. How is God going to deliver him, and what is his action going to be?
Well, and at the end of chapter 27, too, you have this interesting description of David going and continuing to fight against the enemies of the people of God that are further south from Philistia, and how there would be, you know, no one left to bring a report back to Achish, the king of Gath. And how in doing that, you know, in chapter 27, verse 11, and David would leave neither man nor woman alive to bring news to Gath, thinking, lest they should tell about us and say, so David has done. Such was his custom all the while he lived in the country of the Philistines. So even as he's living in the land of the wicked, he's bringing the judgment of God upon the wicked that are further south. So he is still being used by the Lord to bring about justice against those who have consistently rejected the kingship of Yahweh and rejected Yahweh's people as well. And then in chapter 28, as you mentioned, I mean, there's this question of what's going to happen, what's going to take place with David. Is he going to go out with the Philistines as they go out to war against Israel? And then you have this really interesting narrative that we could spend a long time talking about some of the details. This witch at Endor and her calling forth of Samuel, and how did she not know that Saul was the one that was before her? I mean, the tallest guy in the neighborhood, he's there, and somehow she misses the fact. And then we're reminded that Saul had drove out all of the necromancers and mediums, and still we have this witch at Endor who hasn't been driven out. Very consistent for the lack of obedience of the people of Israel, right? Let's go drive out the people except for them. Let's keep somebody back just in case.
Right.
So,
all right. Move to the Philistines eventually. Kind of here we see the rejection of David. So David is even again furthermore isolated, and that kind of, I think, at least as far as I'm concerned, we begin to see chapter 29 and 30 really probably begin to mark the low point in this narrative for David. Right? I mean, not only is he rejected, Saul's coming to get him. He's rejected in Philistia. His wives are going to be captured. This is kind of the you know, and I think we see some of this sentiment in a number of the wilderness psalms, so to speak, you know, that we may not be able to trace them directly to a time period here, but we can kind of get that sentiment that David is expressing before the Lord, right? I mean, God has gotten David almost to the point where he's begun to lose heart, right? Saul's going to kill me. I've got nothing left, you know, what am I going to do? And then God takes him even a little bit lower. And so what, you know, what should we pull from this? What's going on with the capture of the wives? I mean, how big of an insult is that, really? And what culturally, so to speak, is the cultural point is the author trying to make for us?
Sure. Well, you're right. I mean, chapters 29 through 31 really just kind of form one big literary unit, should be read together. And in light of some of those psalms, I mean, what's the one thing that we're reminded of in those psalms of lament as David is crying out and as he's experiencing this lonesomeness in the wilderness? We're constantly being reminded that the Lord is with his people. I mean, even on the lips of David, when he's experiencing the lowest of the lows, he still reminds himself that the Lord will bring about justice and judgment, and the Lord will be with his people. And really that's consistently being displayed. So even as he's rejected by the Philistines, and as David comes back to Ziklag, he finds that the Amalekites have come and they've raided the camp and they've taken his wives and his the persons of his camp. And David goes out in battle against the Amalekites, which again is just, if we remember back, even as far back to Exodus chapter 16, 17, we get this picture of the Amalekites, that there was always going to be animosity between the people of Israel and the Amalekites. Here we just have a continuation of that. And the Lord brings destruction upon the Amalekites through the hand of David. And David saves, as it were, his people that have been taken off from Ziklag. And that's really contrasted with what's going to happen with Saul, right? David goes out into battle against the Amalekites. He conquers the Amalekites and redeems his people. And Saul is going to go out into battle against the Philistines, and he's going to be destroyed. So you got this picture of David delivering Ziklag, but Saul falling in battle. So you got this contrast that's taking place there. And then in chapter 30, as we talked about, I mean, this picture of David going out on behalf of his people, the people going out in battle, and the Lord fighting the battles for his people ultimately. So David defeating the Amalekites and bringing home his family. And that's really how chapter 30 ends, right? In verses 26 and following, when David came to Ziklag, he sent part of the spoil to his friends, the elders of Judah, saying, "Here's a present for you from the spoil of the enemies of the Lord." It was for those in Bethel and Ramoth and Negeb and Jatir and Aror and Sithmoth and Eshtemoa and Rakal and all of those cities. What's really interesting here too is just the way that David acts in wisdom as well, right? It's like, no, some of these guys didn't come into the battle with us. They're not going to receive any of the spoils of war. And David is acting wisely. He's almost, in a sense, displaying the wisdom of a righteous king. And he says, no, look, we're going to disseminate the spoils. Everybody's going to receive his family back. And we're going to celebrate. There's going to be a righteous celebration. And that righteous celebration really then is contrasted in chapter 31 with the death of Saul and the death of Jonathan, and how that's the conclusion to the book of Samuel. Is we just had a righteous celebration in chapter 30, but then we're going to have the death of Saul and Jonathan, and the mourning that comes along with that. So that's really how the book of Samuel ends, for Samuel anyway. It ends on this low note of Saul being killed in battle, of Jonathan being killed in battle, and now the question is, you know, what's going to happen to the people of Israel, right? Yep. Because David's still not back in Israel. He's still right off in the land of the dead, as it were. And then with the rise of David back into the land of Israel, there's a sense of resurrection that occurs, resurrection of the kingship, a resurrection of the righteous king that should rule and reign, although David will have his failures. But it's kind of how 1 Samuel ends and 2 Samuel will begin.
Yeah, so, you know, one of the things that stood out to me, too, is how similar the language is between how the Philistines treat Saul and how David treated Goliath. Cut off his head, strip off the armor, and it's almost a reminder to the reader that Saul really was an enemy of the people, and he too, was an enemy of Israel, cloaked in kingship, and I just found that interesting reading that this morning. So,
yeah. Well, and to that point too, I mean, even in some of the details that we read, what happens to the bodies of Saul and Jonathan? Now, especially Saul, as it were, though, I mean, Saul's body's burned, right?
Right.
It's burned. And in that picture, that's kind of a picture of judgment that yep. falls upon Saul, and how he's being treated like Goliath. And then he experienced the fires of burning. We shouldn't read too much into that because also Jonathan's body's burned as well. Their bones are buried. But, you know, there's also this contrast with, the people of Jabesh. They come and they actually act kindly, which will actually evoke for them a blessing later on in the narrative. So yeah, it's a really interesting contrast between the way that Saul, or at least it'd be more parallel rather than contrasted, but a parallel between how Goliath is treated and the way that Saul himself is treated. Two giants, two champions of the people, both being brought under the judgment of God.
Yep. Yeah, which we see, you know, shadowed in Hannah's prayer and David's prayer, right? So that theme is going to run through. So, well, Nate, what, you know, as people begin reading 2 Samuel, you know, this is all probably one literary chunk, 1st and 2nd Samuel. But what would you, are there anything in particular that you would encourage the readers to look for moving forward? Anything that you say, okay, there's enough of a subtle shift. Right now we're beginning the upswing in monarchy, but is there anything in particular that you would encourage us to be looking for?
So one of the things that I think is just really important for us to see is the way that the Lord is demonstrating his faithfulness to bringing about a righteous king to rule over his people. So you're going to see that over and over again. Really take and pay attention to 2 Samuel chapter 7 and the establishment of David's throne and how from David's line will actually come a righteous king who will be perfectly righteous and who will rule and reign from his throne forever and ever and ever and ever. So you have the rise of, I don't want to say the rise of the monarchy because that actually occurred under Saul, but the rise of a king after God's own heart and what actually is taking place there and how peace in the land looks and how that actually occurs as a righteous king rules and reigns. But then also pay attention as we're going through the narrative to what happens when that king who is representative of the people begins to fall into the ways of the sinful kings that surround him and how quickly that actually has a negative impact, not only on the king and his immediate family, but also the kingdom itself. Mm-hmm. So just kind of be on the lookout for those ways that the Lord is demonstrating his faithfulness to his people through the establishment of a righteous king and what happens when that righteous king acts sinfully and how the Lord will bring judgment both upon the king's family, and the people themselves, which again, is just a reminder, right? We need a righteous king who will not act unfaithfully, right. One who will consistently and forever be our faithful king, which I think is how the people of Israel would have read this account. You know, they would have experienced all of the rising and the falling of kings and constantly just crying out, when will that king who will be perfect in righteousness reign for us in our place? So,
yeah, because if you're reading it, the very first part of 2 Samuel, my guess is that people were saying, okay, this looks to be the one, right? This looks to be the messianic king we've been expecting.
Right.
Very, very quickly that David falls into that prophetic word that Samuel gave, because if you read, you know, the David of Bathsheba account, he's taking, which is the exact same language that Samuel played out of what the king's going to do. And so it's a very quick reminder that this is not the king, right? This is a golden age, so to speak, for Israel on earth. Mm-hmm. And it's about as good as it gets for them on earth, but it's still severely lacking both in the righteousness of the king and the ultimate joy of the people, both in security and in blessing. And it's a reminder for us that the temporal blessings that come through David are still just a shadow of the eternal blessings that are for God's people with the better king. So.
Right. Yeah. And then as they read through, just also compare how Saul reacts to being confronted by his sin and the way David responds and the way that he is confronted by his sin. There is two substantially different responses by two substantially different kings, which then helps us to understand the righteousness of King David and the wickedness of King Saul. And again, that righteousness, I'm not saying David was perfect by any stretch of the imagination, but he at least has a heart that is repentant where Saul does not. So
very good. All right. Well, I appreciate your work, Nate. Why don't you close us in a word of prayer?
Sure. Heavenly Father, we thank you for this morning. We thank you for your word. Lord, I pray that as we continue to read through your word, as we continue to study through your word, as we continue to discuss your word, that your Holy Spirit would be impressing your word upon our hearts, and that your Holy Spirit would be continuing to conform us and transform us more into the image of Jesus. That's the greatest good that we can have in this life. And as a matter of fact, as we're conformed more into the image of Jesus, we actually grow in holiness and love for you. And that, again, is something we desire, Lord. So I pray that you would do so for the glory of your name, the good of your people. And Lord, I pray that we would be a people who consistently look to the skies for the return of our King, who, as he returns, will part the clouds with a sound of a trumpet, will unite all of his people to himself, and he will establish a righteous kingdom, a good kingdom, a new heavens and a new earth forever and ever, where we will dwell with him, and we will live in peace and security, and we will experience the blessing of fellowship with the Father through the Son by the Spirit, our triune God, and the eternal fellowship that we're looking forward to. Lord, help us to be a people who are anxiously longing for that day, and help us to be a people who are dramatically rooted in your word and finding our hope in the finished work of Christ. So, Lord, I pray that you'd be with us, and I pray that you would continue to strengthen us and keep us by your word, by your grace, for your glory. In Jesus' name, amen.
All right. All right. Speak, Lord willing.
All right. Grace and peace, LifePoint.